Okay, and with that, I'd like to hand over to my co-chair Osman, who will be chairing the FICE education session.
Great, thank you.
These are 10 years old. They should have been capitalized. They just spent a quarter year longer.
What's next? We are on AP4.
Okay, so we now kind of move on to what I would think is the ISB's most interesting project. It wasn't a long list of interesting projects, so just kidding. So first of all, what we're going to do in the first hour before a break is to have, which I think we're really looking forward to, is this education session on consumers with cash equity. So that's agenda paper 3. And then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back to kind of the meat of the discussion after the break. So without further ado, over to you.
Okay, so thank you. My name is Yumi Choi, and I'm the project manager for the FICE project here. So if you turn to number two, slide number two, so that's about where we are in terms of the project life cycle. So we are at the research project phase, which means the board has explored different ideas to achieve the project objective that you will see on slide two. And the board has put together the proposals in the form of discussion paper, which has been published in June this year and is open for public comment until early January next year. And the proposals in the discussion paper is based on the feedback that we have received over the years, including those that we have heard from you through the CMAC meeting 2 years ago. So the overarching question for today is really, so these are our proposals. And do you think that will help you? Have we got it right? These are proposals and based on our understanding of your information need, would you find that useful? So that's really the overarching question. And if you have any suggestion as to how we could further improve the proposals to best meet your needs, that's what we really need to hear from you now. And you might be asking, what happens next then? So after receiving feedback, the board will decide what to do next in terms of the project. So one of the possible outcome may be to progress these proposals in a more well-defined proposal and publish an exposure draft, maybe. But that doesn't necessarily mean all the proposals in the discussion paper that you see today will survive to the next phase. And by talking to some of the outreach meeting, we are already facing some challenges from some preparers about whether these additional information disclosure requirements, whether they are really worth the effort and money, which I think is a valid challenge. So for us to be able to progress these proposals to the next stage, we really need a strong voice from you about whether you would really find these additional information useful for your purposes. So if you move on to slide three, this is how this session is going to run today. So I have been lucky enough to secure two sessions with you. So in the first one, you will hear more of me talking, touching on the key proposals in the discussion paper. And I want to focus more on disclosure and presentation part of the proposal because I think that would be of more interest and relevance to you. But I will, at the end of the education session, I will also touch on the classification and what are the principles that we are proposing in terms of classifying financial instruments as either liability or equity. And in the second session, we are hoping that I could be in a more of a listening mode so that we can hear from you what you think about the proposal and whether you have any suggestions to enhance the proposals that we have today. So, if you move on to slide five, so these are some of the examples of what we have commonly heard from the investors. But essentially, what we heard from the investors is that we need more information about financial instruments issued by a company, especially equity instruments. And on slide number six, we have provided an anonymized example to facilitate your thinking or discussion about the information that you get currently about equity instruments. And maybe what you could think about is whether would you have, or do you have enough information to understand the terms of the equity instruments, especially about other equity instrument or convertible bonds from this note? Can you get enough information about the rationale as to why these instruments are classified as equity, applying the existing accounting standard IAS 32? And what about priorities on liquidation? And also whether some of these equity instruments could affect or dilute the existing ordinary shareholders? And if you think about what the current IFRS standard requires, is it has a lot more comprehensive requirement, disclosure requirements of financial liability than equity instruments. So we think that must be why the investors have been telling us that we need more information about equity instruments. And also, we think it might be the reason why some investors still prefer so-called a narrow equity approach or a basic ownership approach, under which only the ordinary share will be classified as equity and everything else is liability, so that those liabilities are subject to more comprehensive disclosure and measurement requirements. So our proposal, if you move on to slide 7, our proposal is really to provide more information about equity instruments. And the question is then, what information? So if you think about what information that you would get today, for some companies, you will get the EPS information as well as diluted earnings per share. And if the company is a group company and has non-controlling interest, you will get some idea about how the returns of the companies are attributed to non-controlling interest versus the owner of the parent. So our proposal is to supplement those information by these additional information, and I want to talk to you about three different disclosure today, as well as attribution later on when I go through the presentation piece of discussion paper. So we have provided an example of the first disclosure, which is maximum dilution of ordinary shares, so on slide 8. So if you look at this table, in the first column, you will see the number of ordinary shares in issue as of the reporting date, and how those outstanding ordinary shares, what the number of outstanding ordinary shares are at the beginning of the period and at the end of the period, and how it changes during the period. So the additional bit that we are proposing is to give the users of financial statements the information about what are the maximum number of potential ordinary shares. What do we mean by that is, if the company had issued share options or convertible bond, for example, and how many shares the company may need to issue to settle those convertible bond or if the options are exercised. So this is really to supplement the diluted earnings per share information, where the dilution within diluted EPS is defined quite narrowly. So it will consider only those instruments that are currently in the money as of the reporting date, but not necessarily capture other potential ordinary share issues. So this is really to give you the data so that you can assess the potential dilution of existing shares using the data about the maximum number of shares that could be issued. So if you turn to slide 9, the objective is really to help you assess the potential dilution. And what the board is thinking is, in addition to the information about the numbers of potential ordinary shares, it could also provide information about the voting right and how those additional potential shares could affect the voting right of existing ordinary shares. By the way, if you have any questions that you want to clarify, I think this is the session to do that, so please feel free to ask questions. Yeah. And the second disclosure.
Does Goro have a question?
Just checking, please. You might have left it over from the previous session.
Goro, do you have a question? Your name tag is up. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
No worries. The second disclosure that we are thinking about is about priority on liquidation. And we understand that some of the security regulator requires similar information when the company issues or lists the security in the offering document of the security. The companies sometimes need to provide this capitalization table type information, which will essentially pull together all financial instruments issued by the company, both liabilities and equity, and show the information about what are the relative priority on liquidation of those instruments. Currently, IFRS standard doesn't really require disclosure about priorities on liquidation, so we think this information could be useful for the investors in understanding how the different instruments have relative ranking on liquidation. But we are aware of challenges, so on slide 11, we have provided some examples. So for example, we understand that because of different jurisdictional requirements, laws on regulation, and potential impact of how the group structure affects the priority, sometimes it is quite challenging to provide this priority information on a consolidated group basis, for example. And also, sometimes the priority will be affected by some contingent events, uncertain future events. So how do you capture those contingencies within the table may be one of the questions. And also, we are aware that there may be some non-financial claims which could affect the priority of financial, which could come before or within those priority of financial liabilities and equity instruments, for example, obligation to the employees or tax payable may come before all these financial liabilities and equity issued by the company. So, but despite those challenges, the board thinks that this information could be useful because in the absence of these information, the investors yourselves will have to perform your own assessment based on even limited information. So the question that we really want to ask you is, despite these limitations, would you still find this priority information useful, even if it had to be provided with some simplifying assumption? And maybe how it could be made more useful is having this table based on some simplifying assumption, but that simplifying assumption be disclosed so that you are aware of what limitation this information is provided. And the last disclosure that I want to touch on is on slide 12. So this is about terms and condition of financial instruments. So it could be terms and condition that affects either the timing or the amount of the cash flows or settlement amounts. So how and whether those amounts are affected by any contingencies. And the proposal is also to provide this information in a single place in the financial statement so that it's easier for you to locate this information in the annual report. But it comes with challenges as well. So it's especially if the company have issued a lot of financial instruments, providing this information about terms and conditions for each financial instrument could be quite a lot of information and might not necessarily be useful for you because you will be buried in information. So the challenges is about how granular this information should be provided and if they were to be aggregated on what basis. So on slide 13 and 14 are some questions that we wanted to ask, but basically it's about whether you think it will be useful and how useful. We appreciate that it will be difficult to attach a value to a qualitative importance of disclosure, but what will be really helpful for us is to understand whether it's, oh yes, this is absolutely useful, we definitely need this information, versus, oh well, it could be useful if X, Y, and Z. So it would be really helpful for us to understand the sense of how important this information and how valuable it is to you. Okay.
One is, so I think you might have answered that already partly on slide 13, but I was kind of wondering, you know, why we have to sort of really rank these three? I mean, could we just say, you know, they're all very important? Because ultimately, I mean, you know, there's no reason why we can't have everything. And this question is a bit like, you know, asking are equity more investors more important than debt investors or not?
Okay, yeah, that's a fair question. But what we want to gauge from that question is, like, because it's quite hard to describe how valuable certain pieces of information is, we wanted to just get a sense of which one tend to be on the first extreme that I described. Oh yes, I definitely needed this information versus oh maybe it could be useful type of usefulness. So we just wanted to get a sense, but I think everything is important equally is also a possible answer. So if you do think that, then that would be helpful for us to know as well.
Thank you. And then just one clarifying question in terms of the scope of this. So does this only cover sort of like issued securities?
Correct.
Or does it, because basically, for example, I mean, if you have a bank, you know, and they pay deferred compensation to their analyst traders, whatever, some actually pay it in actual shares that are going to be vesting,
okay.
And some would, you know, just issue quasi shares, which is basically just a payment promise for the future that is contingent on certain criteria and also just linked to the share price. How would that be outside of the scope of this project then?
Short answer, yes. So we do have a separate standard that deals with an employee share-based compensation. So the board is not planning to change that proposal. The scope of this project will be touching on financial instruments issued by the company, really.
Okay, we've got a few cards up, so maybe it's a good point to kind of pause and take these questions or comments. So starting with Jeff.
Just quickly go through this. The maximum dilution of ordinary shares, I attempt to do that already. So that is a good thing if you are contributing to that information. We'll look at it in M&A situations, change of control, just to try and figure out the potential dilution there. We'll look at it from an equity hang perspective of trying to figure out to what extent equity overhangs are priced into a stock. So anything like that is useful. Voting rights, again, I attempt to do that where the information is available. If it's more freely available, that's a plus point for us. On the priority of liquidation, I love the idea. I just hate to have to do it. If it was me trying to put that together with contractual and structural subordination intertwining, the ranking there, that is difficult, but it's one of those things. I think if you did it at a high level, it becomes less useful, because within subordinated loans or junior secured, there could be four or five different tranches of debt of different amounts, and then it becomes important to know where those tranches actually rank. So it's one of those things I would like to have more detail, but more detail, it becomes increasingly complicated trying to achieve that. Given we have nothing at the moment, and I'm guessing anything's an improvement on that basis. And I have to admit, I got kind of excited about the first 2 points, and I missed the third one. So I've got nothing to say on the third one, because I was thinking about the first two.
Thanks, Jeff. Martin?
Thank you. I'd like to echo the importance of the insight in dilution. We're talking about having to do an awful lot of work as analysts to estimate cash flows within boundaries, and then we're completely out of the woods. But how many shares there may be outstanding 2 years from now? So it's like this is about the bare ownership of the company. Do you own 1.2% or 0.8 after 3 years? It's really critical information. I'm just wary that the maximum dilution is like indeed a critical thing to know, but it may just not be enough. I mean, it's not just that it's a binary scenario, the maximum dilution or nothing. I mean, if there is a myriad of financial instruments with characteristics of equity outstanding, there I think the company should be able to provide basic scenarios that you have an insight in. If the share price increases 20% or 40%, what the impact on these shares outstanding will be. So just maximum dilution, I think, is necessary, but not enough for to grasp the true complexity. On liquidation priority, or on the ranking, you actually in practice have the complication that a very junior loan can actually be extremely safe because it is maturing next month, half a year from now.
Mm.
Whereas a very secured loan dated 30 years from now is not that safe at all, and it would rank in this list in the reverse. So it doesn't mean that this effort would be futile, mm-hmm. but I think a different route is more appropriate, and that is that insight is given in the group structure of those entities within the group that are issuing debt and are provided in a group structure. Any company does this in the prospectus. If they issue a bond, there's always a group structure. So it's like, but somehow I can imagine it will be challenging to from a standard set of perspective to say, okay, provide us with a relevant group structure. Because that would be I think the challenge to find wording that requires the inclusion of the current group structure, because group structures change over time, and the bonds are still there, and you have no idea sometimes where your bond is because the group structure has changed. So it's
one of those situations. I think you have to look at this in different lenses. So we'll look at it from a legal perspective, then you look at it from a structural perspective, and then you're looking at it from a time perspective as well. So, you know, trying to pick kind of one definition that fits all three lenses is kind of difficult at the best of times.
Yeah, I agree. Several lenses are very helpful there.
Mm.
Whether you want to do that or not is another matter.
Yeah. Let's see. On slide 14, I see a really dangerous suggestion that to limit the disclosures to the parent entity only, let's not do that. I mean, that's really a bad idea. Okay. I mean, then you can say, okay, never mind, because it's the parent only is the most easy to analyze. It's about the stuff that's not in the parent that needs the disclosures. So, and what came to mind about, because you were saying, what do we do with companies issuing many instruments?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about meta, or aggregated numbers like unencumbered assets. Mm-hmm. How many unencumbered assets are left within the company? So those assets that still can be put forward as a collateral to potential new loans. That gives you as investor a valuable insight in whether the company will be able to refinance something with, for example, more collateral that is still available. If all the assets are already pledged, I mean, that's really critical information.
Right.
So really good to also focus on information that is maybe on aggregate relevant in this perspective.
Can I just come in very quickly? So I think you raised a very helpful point about priority and how the timing of those settlement matters. So under the current IFRS standard, there is some requirement to disclose the timing of the settlement of financial liability in terms of the liquidity analysis. But so do you think this priority information will be more helpful if you could link it back to that timing analysis together, maybe?
And but the unfortunately, not all maturity schedules are on an annual basis, and we do need them on an annual basis. I mean, this is you need those on an annual basis. You don't want cohorts between the 15 and 25 years. We need to repay X million. That's right. What you not want. You want it on a this is
more granular.
More granular, yeah.
And also just on the...
You can skip those years where there's no maturity, no cohorts.
And just one more thing on the maximum dilution. You mentioned some sort of scenario analysis will be useful. What about if we were to provide the maximum dilution information along with the data that will enable you to do the scenario analysis, such as maybe the strike price and other terms and conditions of these instruments that could require future issues of ordinary shares? Do you think that will give you
I don't understand your proposal. Please, can you please explain it again?
So, because you mentioned that scenario analysis type information will be useful for you to analyze the maximum dilution of ordinary shares. So what if we were to provide what we are proposing as a table, but also provide the terms and conditions of those instruments, such as strike price, or when those could be exercised, the date, maturity date, or conversion date? Do you think that will give you enough to do your own scenario analysis?
Yeah. That would be really helpful, but still a basic sensitivity.
Okay.
Is like it should be quite easy for a company to provide. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the ownership. I don't want to underestimate the relevance of basic ownership. I mean, this is the thing is, if you can, I'm a bit wary when there are very many different option series. That we get like a list of 120 different instruments, and then we need to figure it out what the dilution in any scenario is. And probably there's some wisdom in basic scenario analysis that complements your suggestion.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. So. I'm going to do Carlos next, and then Peter.
Yeah, first, you mentioned many times just doing giving information on ordinary shares, but most of the times, preferred shares may be converted to ordinary, and so there are all kinds of preferred shares, so that may be a problem, but. I think you should consider also preferred shares. Just to give you an example, in Brazil, most of the preferred shares are quite similar to ordinary, but without a vote. But they have the same, small details, but they have very similar payoffs. On the priorities of on liquidation, I think it's very useful. I think more and more. Obviously, we have all kinds of investors. I am an equity investor, but there are all kinds of debt investors. More and more, we have people investing across the capital structure and trying to compare different alternatives.
Yeah.
So that's definitely important. What I think is that, you may have lots of public information on the characteristics of certain fixed income securities. It's very, very hard to put all that together. So obviously, if the company can in some way summarize for investors how the whole structure looks like the group structures that Maita mentioned, that's nice. What may be interesting is that there may be also non-public securities with different kinds of priorities on liquidation that investors just cannot know. Or they just cannot know where there are other securities. So maybe one way to go is just make sure that the company provides both what is public and non-public. And obviously this is sensitive because there may be other confidentiality agreements and things like that. But I think many times investors when they look at the capital structure they do not have the complete picture.
Carlos, any other comments from you?
No.
We'll go to Peter, and then I'll
say his name.
In most companies that I look at, I don't have any problems with this.
Okay.
But when I have companies with a lot of dilution effect, I have problems finding the effects and so on. And I also, to some extent, have problems finding if there are dilution effects, particularly in companies that goes down, the share price goes down, so the dilution effect in earnings per share is not calculated. In that perspective, I think to have the maximum amount of shares might help me find those companies that there are, might occur problems in this sense in the future. So I think, and I also think the cost for producing that information is very small. You have it. Period. So just put it in. I think that would be helpful.
priority and claims on liquidation, hopefully I'm out of the company long before that happens, because I'm an equity investor, so I hardly ever look at that perspective. I never have that perspective, so I cannot really require the companies to present information in that sense to me, so I'm not so interested. Terms and conditions that affect the timing and the amount of cash flow. Yes, I think that is constantly a problem when you have dilution effects and you try to understand when and how they will occur. So I think to me, A and C is helpful. A, I think, is rather cheap or less not so costly to produce. C, definitely costly, a lot of assumption, uncertainty, and so on. But since the information in C would be very helpful, I think, I would, if you push me for only one alternative, I would take C as the most useful one. Thank you. I might say, referring to Martin, I love most of the stuff that you say, but this is also an area where we have to be careful for disclosure overload. Because if we want to have include a lot of information regarding convertible bonds and other stuff, we will definitely overload the annual report, so I would be very careful for in that perspective. But I love your ideas, but in this sense, I'm more afraid of disclosure overload than the usefulness.
Okay, so I've just been reminded that actually the idea was that we'd have this 1 hour as the education session and then the Q&A afterwards, but I think classic CMAC fashion, people do want to kind of give their views, which I think is fantastic. So. Yuni, I think if you agree, what we'll do then is maybe these three questions we'll continue with.
I think so. If you find that's easier, that's going to be more effective. Very happy to do it by like that. So if I present a section, then you can all come in, so that we are basically combining the education session and the later session. Yeah, happy.
Okay. So next is Celine.
Just to clarify, this doesn't, stock options are included in this or not? Share-based payments is separate.
If it's an employee share options, then no.
Okay, because I mean, I'll make the point anyway. Recently had a discussion around this, but companies that perhaps use more share-based comp, they've got an operational leverage advantage in the sense of they could perhaps pay less in staff costs and defer that cash flows in the future. So, I mean, applying that to here, just more broadly, I think C, I reckon the points that Peter said is most valuable. Yeah. In terms of dilution, yes, we do that. That's valid. And then in terms of the priority of claims, again, less applicable for us. From an equity perspective, we tend to look at economic debt. So regardless of where that priority is, I mean, we're grouping it up with pensions and we capitalise operating leases, so we combine that all together. So. Again, we're not less precise in terms of liquidation because we're always looking at things on a going concern basis.
All right.
So.
Okay, so Mary?
A couple of things that I want to ask you to think about in responding to questions. I think it's always very useful to us when we're re-deliberating to have specifics about how you use particular pieces of information. And so I found, you know, Salim, just your comment about you're looking at economic debt useful, but also, you know, having heard, by my count, I think three CMAC members say we currently are trying to estimate dilution, and that's something that you're trying to do today, and why you do that is very useful. So just in terms of, yes, I'd like this information, that, you know, or I prioritize that, that's useful, but it's also very good to be able to understand how you use it. Sometimes what we find when we're doing re-deliberations is if preparers say that's hugely costly, and we say, but this is what people are trying to do, they will come up with some good suggestions about how to satisfy that objective in, you know, in an alternate way. So the more we know about how you use the information, the better it is for us to take it forward. I think, for example, being specific about what information you need to feed the analyses that you do, the data in components that you need, again, specificity is helpful. personal, you know, Uni referred in her tee up to some regulators requiring some of this information. And, you know, I think, for example, and I'm out of practice, but the US SEC requires some information in a cap table in securities offerings, but not on an ongoing basis. I'd be interested from you, if you're looking at US offerings, if you find that information in the cap table useful and how you use it, or, you know, or if you don't, just again as an example of specificity.
I think that's useful sort of practical example of how we're using the information. So I'm going to go to Glenn and then Paolo.
On dilution, I don't really have much by way of comments, but I'm very interested and I'm very supportive of the idea of the disclosures on subordination and the ranking of ranking of instruments. The difficulty here, and I understand the I understand that this is not an easy challenge. I take the point you made here. But the question that comes to my mind is, if we can't do it and we can't specify a standard by which it's done, it's very difficult for management to do it either. So this becomes a stewardship question, which is, how on earth do you manage a situation where nobody knows what the priority claims are and how they should be and how they should be ranked? And I think that's an important disclosure in itself, because just simply knowing that you can't do it should give investors something to think about.
The known unknown.
There's a wonderful book that's just been published, and everybody who's interested in the crash and what went wrong and what went right in the crash should read it. It's Adam Tooze's book on crash. And one of the points that Adam Tooze makes in the book was that the biggest source of funding, emergency funding for the European banks, which were the epicenter of the crisis in London and in Switzerland particularly, was the Federal Reserve, which was not the central bank of Europe. And it was not the Bank of England or the Bank of Switzerland advancing liquidity. It was the Federal Reserve advancing dollar liquidity against collateral. The question is, what collateral? Because the Fed is not allowed to take unguaranteed collateral. And I don't remember the precise details, but one of the statements he makes in the book was that none of the relevant disclosures appeared in the financial statements of the banks in question. Now, it may be that we don't have to analyze the ranking of subordination for equity, but I can tell you that the Fed had claims over the equity of all those banks as a result of providing the liquidity support that was necessary. If you were an equity investor in a bank, you might want to have known that and to be able to analyze it. So the point you made about how much pledged assets versus unpledged assets, what level of subordination and seniority, where it is, even if the banks can't do this or property companies or highly levered companies can't do this, I think it's important to say that they can't. And the moment they say that, I think they will realize, and their non-executive directors who have to read those statements to sign off on them, will realize that this is a model problem, this is a stewardship problem, because a lot of these companies, in the end, will depend on somebody, brackets the taxpayer, in the case of systemically important entities, providing a backstop, which is kind of never thought about and questioned, but could be. And it, I'm not saying there's a particular answer to this, I'm just saying that the fact that it's difficult tells you something useful about how you should price the security. Mm-hmm. Sorry, and one more thing. On the information overload, remember today, you know, half the people around the table, I'm the only one with papers, I think. So everyone else is using their laptops and computers. We can provide reams of information online. The overload does not mean that you have to do what I've done, just to print out the stack on this thing. We can have all the disclosures that are necessary in aggregate form online for people who want to use it. And with references, with hyperlinks that click into that in the future. We don't have to be worried about the kilograms of disclosure that come with all this. You can have aggregate data, which you can, you know, break down in online in further detail. I think the important thing is to have the information and to know it and to be able to use it to price your securities properly.
Okay. Just one comment that came into my mind as you were speaking, Glenn, is, you know, the question I had when I was looking through these papers is, is all of this the remit of the ISB when you're talking about reams and reams of disclosure of securities of offering documents, etc.? You know, what are securities regulators doing? And I just wonder whether we should kind of bear that in mind in terms of what we want versus what the ISB could deliver or should be delivering. So something to bear in mind. So we're going to go to Paolo, then Jeff, and then Marietta.
Getting James. I think James is probably ahead of me. I'm happy to take his place.
James. Go for it, James.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Right. So first of all, on C, terms and conditions, bank investor perspective, there is a Basel-required document called the Pillar 3 Instruments Disclosure. Unfortunately, as with most Basel things, we have countries and bank systems that comply to the letter, usually Northern Europe, and there are countries and bank systems who don't comply. This would be a useful backup for capital instruments. It's absolutely impossible for non-capital instruments. So, you know, I would say you'd need an exemption carve-out for the term used in the previous presentation, slide 18, I think. Where you carve out whatever you describe banks as whose primary function is to provide finance, you can't do that. It's just, and I disagree with Glenn on that point. I think you have a 10 megabyte emailable limit for most places on a PDF document. I think that would just really push it over if you're going to have every single bond issued by every bank in a document, in a single document. That is just not feasible for where it's a funding instrument. So for banks, I would see, as it is currently formed, is impossible, but it would be very useful to say for capital, solvency capital instruments, where there is this Basel requirement. If you don't do it by Basel, it would be great belt and braces if the ISB requires it. That's point number one. So then on the point B, the priority of claims on liquidation, I love the idea. I think, yes, there is the structural subordination versus the contractual subordination matter here. I can provide you with the way I do it. If you want to have an example, I will send that to you. So I basically put non-operating holding companies in their ranking within the consolidated groups. This is what's in the non-operating holding company. This is what's in the operating holding company by rank. I can send you an example. It is possible, but I do think you probably do need that structural versus contractual. And I was once an equity analyst, and I would have dreamt of a maximum dilution of ordinary shares. Absolutely dreamt of that.
Thank you.
The comment is hard to argue against more information, motherhood, and Apple Pie, but we're not talking only about information. In a way, we're talking about judgment, actually. I mean, it's based on due diligence I do all the time. In many cases, you have to consider, first, gross default, acceleration based on debt equity ratios, acceleration based on change of interest rates, first, second, and fifth degree mortgages and pledges. If you put this everything together, determine what comes first and what goes last, and changes or could change every other month. Okay. So preparing a table with liquidation preferences, frankly, would not be easy. And I may be exaggerating a little bit, but it's really not 100% reliable. Changes all the time and will generate a huge amount of information. At the end, you'll be trying to sum up 100 page times 20, 30 bond indenture. This is really not simple.
So what we are thinking is we appreciate those challenges. So maybe there could be one table based on some assumption, but disclosing what assumptions that management had to make to produce that table, and plus how those priority provided in the table could change if on the occurrence of certain and uncertain future events.
Yeah, you could end up with the kind of 10 dimensions matrix.
Yeah.
I think it's just a well-timed comment. I was going to say that scenario analysis and sensitivity analysis, if I get it in a set of accounts, let's say to do with pensions, it's nice to have that. I then kind of want to ignore it, and then I want to do my own sensitivity and my own scenarios. I don't think it's the job of the International Accounting Standards Board to take the fun out of my job. And the fun out of my job is looking at the disclosures that I am given and then modeling, sensitizing, running scenarios and trying to form my view. And my view is probably going to be different to the view that's presented in the set of accounts. So it's that fine line between presenting disclosure numbers and insight around those numbers versus actually trying to do the analysis. I think the analysis is in the eye of the beholder at that stage.
Okay, so we're going to go to Marietta, Martine, and then Goro, and then it's probably time for a coffee break.
So I really just wanted to comment on the subject of disclosure overload, and I agree with everything that's been said so far. But I do think in this case, when you look at slide 12, I think we should err on the side of disclosure overload and be very, very careful about the aggregation we allow. Because basically, in my experience, management tends to refuse to consider any scenario where they could go bust or get into real trouble. So if you actually say to them, you know, on page 12, you know, apply your judgment on materiality, they're going to say, for example, if you have a dodgy biotech company that has already had a number of refinancing, a number of setbacks, they're not going to be making any money for the next 5 to 8 years. They're constantly trying to avoid bankruptcy. They will need to get very, very creative in order to actually get the financing they need to make it into next year. So a lot of times they have A, super complicated dilution issues, and B, they will, for example, issue convertible bonds that are recallable in the event that their share price falls below a certain level. And, you know, if you talk to management about that, I've been in a situation where I haven't had that disclosure, and management would say, yeah, you know, this is if our share price falls below X, but that's a very, very unlikely scenario. Okay, I don't want management speculating about what's going to happen to their share price. And then they say, well, even if that does happen, then, you know, the bondholders appreciate that this company is so much more valuable than the share price could ever reflect. And I don't want them speculating about bondholders' behavior either. So I think, you know, it needs to be very, very clear under what circumstances, you know, money could actually leave the company. However unlikely management thinks it, and I also think it's very important to get a full view of the potential dilution that could happen. And this is where we're only talking about financial instruments right now. I mean, ultimately, the ultimate dilution is going to be a lot higher because you know they're going to have another financing rounds where they're going to be issuing new convertible bonds. And I do think that, I mean, this should fall under the remit of IFRS because I think, you know, I mean, I look at the financial statements to understand the assets and liabilities and financial health and financial flexibility of a company. And all of these disclosures are absolutely necessary to understand that. And my impression is just, you know, when it comes to, you know, the front half of the annual report and securities regulators, you know, a lot of these other regulators just don't do very much. So IFRS are the only ones who can help us here.
Okay.
Yeah. Mary had a very concrete question. How do you calculate, how do you take your approach on dilution? And basically, after our job of valuing the, generally for industrial companies, the firm, we need to back out the value that's going to other claims. And then you end up, okay, so this is more or less available for equity, and then a implied share price results. And then you need to know how many, if your projection comes out, how many shares will be issued if the share price is around that that earmark. And then, and you need to know how many shares will be issued when shares are around that earmark. So, and then you can correct the share price for the dilution at that level. And that's one approach, but there are various others. But So that's the kind of thing, and that's how we would use, I think, the information. And okay, so we expect the share price of that. Oh, then there's the dilution of that. Then we know what kind of share price we can, and then can say, okay, so the upside is much less than we expected, because there's a huge amount of dilution going on. And then you can really, that can influence investment decisions. And if you think you have an upside of 25%, but after dilution it's 12, well, then there's that's like noise. And that's how we would use it. Over information overload, of course, not the entire prospectus, because that's data, but it's up to the standard setter to help how information on all those prospectuses can be incorporated. And not data, information. And I'd like to echo the comments on covenants. I think it is like 8 years ago that Eumedion asked for insight in the levels of the covenants and the actual performance on those defined covenants to all Dutch companies. And within, I think, 3 years, all industrial or non-financial companies provided that information in a table. Okay, we have these types of debt that have these covenants, and these debts have debt covenants. And you can look it up. Very critical information. And it turns out that the more companies are in difficult territory, the better information they give about covenants. But the problem is that when they're in good territory and they don't provide the information, people can panic big time, and share prices can halve within a day, because people fear that the company may hit its covenants. And if you as a company don't provide it, you cause more volatility than actually maybe economically is warranted. So it's actually very critical information, also from an economic stability point of view.
Mm. Thanks, Martijn. So, Goro?
Thank you. I think that the items listed on page 13 is important. And I used to be a bank analyst when at the midst of the banking crisis in Japan. And at the time, Japanese banks issued a lot of convertible preference shares to support their capital. And my problem was that there were so many such products or instruments. And I needed to study or investigate what kind of terms and conditions of each of these instruments. And after I conducting research on that, what I did was that, you know, with all the information, I knew that the kind of strike prices of all these instruments, then I could make some kind of schedule or table to show that at what level of share prices that the potential dilution would be. So in addition to the maximum dilution, that kind of table to show at what level of the share prices, what dilution we would have, should be very, you know, useful too for us to know what is that kind of that the potential dilution at, and also that the potential market capitalization, et cetera. So that if we have item A, maximum dilution, and also that C, terms and condition, that I do believe that the preparers can make that kind of table by themselves, which would be very, very beneficial to users. Thank you.
Thanks, Goro. Rosemary.
I think Goro has made the same comment I was going to make, that I think all the information is very useful, A, B, C, but if you had to force the ranking, I mean, A is obviously important, and C, and then from that, I think you can figure out sort of liquidation if you have all the terms and conditions.
Okay.
The other comments were made about scenario analysis. I think, I think someone else's point, I mean, I think if you have that information, I don't think it's the ISAB that has to put the scenario analysis together, but if you have all that information, then we can go away and do it ourselves.
Okay, so slight change in the format. So we got a 15-minute break now. Second hour, we've covered three questions, but there's five more to cover.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we'll have you pick up from slide 15.
Yep.
The education session, and we'll take the questions from that. Mary, sorry.
I want to check the accuracy of a message I'm getting, and also I forgot, despite it linking to one of my favorite subjects, share-based payment, to comment when I commented before, which is, you know, Uni said in response, somebody over here, I can't remember who, asked about the interaction with share-based payment. I think we have to think about how we do that because, frankly, I had assumed that the example table on dilution, which is on slide maybe 9, no, on slide 8, would incorporate any outstanding options issued, you know, under share-based payment because they are part of maximum dilution. But I think one of the, you know, we aren't looking at changing IFRS 2 in terms of existing disclosure requirement terms and conditions, strike prices, et cetera. We wouldn't want to replicate them saying you have to disclose it here and you have to disclose it there. But I think your question makes us think about how we integrate the two so that you get a single picture of the overall maximum dilution, you know, bringing it together rather than saying you go here for the ones issued to employees and here for the other ones. But this is not a project about reconsidering the disclosure requirements in IFRS 2. So it's more about linkage. But the message I wanted to check that I was hearing is many people saying that they make different calculations. Martin, you spelled out how you would approach it, related to dilution and the pricing of equity. I think, Glenn, was it you who said, I don't want management's output of sensitivity because if I disagree with the assumptions they've made, or if I have concerns, I don't know what the assumptions that they have made. I'm not going to use the output. I want the inputs to, you know, to be able to make my own assessment. And I heard that message from several people. I don't know if it's realistic, but I think what this is a variant to, you know, those like Martin who are maybe pushing a bit more for the company doing sensitivity, you know, payout sensitivity or some kind of participation curves at this price, you get this transfer at this, you know, at this price, is maybe trying to identify whether there are certain thresholds where, you know, where there are some changes in, you know, in participation.
Company-specific thresholds.
Company-specific thresholds rather than as share price goes up, this happens. But the other thing I say to you is wait for after the break and the discussion Uni is going to lead about attribution and whether or not that would be helpful. You know, again, it might be something that is very costly. It would be very costly to do. And you may look at the examples and say, give me the inputs. Don't push it all the way to the attribution. Or you may say, no, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for. So keep these questions in mind about dilution when we come to attribution.
Okay. Great. So, time for a coffee break, and we'll gather again in. What time do you say, Fred?
11:45.
11:45.
Great.